When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, Dan. Welcome to Practical History. I'm so happy that you were able to make it today.
Patrick, thank you for having me on your show.
So, I want to introduce yourself publicly as a historian investor. And this is very intriguing to a lot of people. It will be intriguing. So, let me introduce you by mentioning a few stages in your career. Just to give us a sense of where you're coming from. In 1984, you had a PhD in Soviet history at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And then for 3 years, you worked actually in academia as an assistant professor of history at the University of Wyoming in Wyoming. And then, filming in your LinkedIn profile, you reappeared in New York City as a senior analyst at Argus Research, where you worked for 3 years. Meanwhile, we did a postdoc at Hoover, a prestigious institution in California. And you also published a book in 1998 titled Storming the Heavens. And this is an academic book about an early Soviet organization that promoted atheism. And then in 1999, you started working as a senior portfolio analyst at Federated Hermes. Meanwhile, you've also been a very prolific writer. You wrote 3 books on finance, including your forthcoming book, The Ownership Dividend, many publications in Soviet history. I saw that you continue publishing in Soviet history. I noticed that you have a 100-piece in the Journal of Critica a few years ago. So I'd love to know more about these disentanglements between finance and history. I had a lot of questions, and I think what you'll be able to share with us will be very useful and inspiring to a lot of people who are wondering about this connection. So, questions about your choices, your experiences, and possibly any of this for people.
Sure. So there's a lot there. That's a long question. Let me simplify it a little bit by kind of breaking my adult life into 2 sections. It is the historian of the Soviet Union, modern Russia. It was Soviet Union when I started, modern Russia when I ended. And then I've ended up for the last, call it 20-some years, working in asset management as a portfolio manager. I'm still kind of a historian because I write about it, but I've had 2 careers. And the part that your timeline had some dates right, some dates wrong, but for the purposes of people understanding it and perhaps trying to figure it out if they're how to apply humanities to business or making a career transition. It really was a break from one to the other. And if you notice, the part of your timeline that's correct is that there's a couple years missing.
Right.
And I had a series of very short-term, very painful, very difficult, very unsuccessful jobs.
Okay.
I remain friends with several of the people from that period, but it certainly wasn't based on my productivity in those first business jobs. So I remained in academia until 1997. My academic book came out in 1998, but I left academia in 1997 after a PhD and a couple of years teaching and a postdoc and getting the note from the publisher. Something that, you know, a lot of young academics really wanted to finish up, understood, get that PhD. Yeah. I was fortunate enough to get a position, and I was fortunate enough to get a postdoc, and I was fortunate enough to get a book published at a high-quality academic press. So as soon as all of that happened, I then made the shift. I had already been having, I have to say, and this is relevant also to academic communities, some doubts. There are real doubts, and they always exist when you're committing to a career as to whether, really, just to put it in blunt terms, the supply and demand of that career is going to work for you or not work for you. And with the Soviet Union collapsing, Russia collapsing, I could see where enrollments were going, job listings were going. I had entered the profession when the Cold War funding and infrastructure of Cold War funding and university support for this career line was full. And by the time I came out ready with a new PhD and a high quality book, the world had changed dramatically, and I could see that. And I said, well, I probably should consider doing something else. I'll probably be okay if I want to stay here, but I don't know if I'd be the happiest camper in the world. I also have to say, Patrick, I was studying Russian history. You may have observed, as will most of your listeners, that Russian history is hard. It's hard on the soul. And it remains hard on the soul. And the last 25 years of Russian history has not made it any easier on the soul. And I admire my colleagues and friends who have remained in the profession as studying modern Russia, trying to explain Russia to itself, to them, and to the modern world. But it's hard because it's a hard place. And I have to admit, I wondered whether I had it in me to study a place that is so challenging for a full career. So in any case, the lines aligned, the stars aligned, and I decided to move on. What is the point of these conversations? And I've given a number of these kind of job talks about the pitfalls of making a career transition. Keep in mind, in 1997, I was 33 years old. I'd never opened an Excel spreadsheet. Never opened an Excel spreadsheet. I had no accounting and no business experience. So I spent the next 2 years absolutely miserable, taking on the job learning. I did not want to go back and get an MBA. It's the late 1990s. I am, as I said, kind of multiple jobs, learning as I go, and on the job MBA, desperately trying to catch up with people 10 years younger than me. It was not a pleasant period. So for those of you looking at career transitions, A, don't wait until you're 33. B, before you do it, know how Excel works and take a few online accounting courses. We'll circle back to suggestions, but a little bit of insight into those suggestions. So I spent 2 years transitioning. I did get to find a kind of a low level, but proper, much appreciated, pretty good, enjoyable, intellectually rewarding job in 1999, after 2 years, and I want to give credit to John Eade, the CEO and president of that business. It's called Argus Research. It's an independent stock research firm working in New York. And I worked there for 3 years from 99 to 2002, and then I ended up at Federated. But Argus is a really interesting platform for academics and humanities majors who might be looking to something in business, because Argus, as an independent research shop, puts a premium on communication, on written communication and research. You need to know your stuff. You need to know the accounting. You need to know whatever you need to know about the particular businesses that you're looking at. But that can be learned. But at least it's been in my experience the last 25 years, writing well is not something that's taught in the business schools. Writing well is not taught in the accounting programs. Writing well and communicating is not taught well in the finance programs. And so Argus and these independent research shops and other, I'll call them almost satellite businesses around Wall Street, require people who can do research and write and conceptualize. Now, they have to research and write and conceptualize about business issues, about cash flows, about balance sheets. So that's an acquired skill. And if you don't acquire it, it's a bust. But they come to the table with more of those skills than maybe they appreciate. So that's, again, a lead into what I think is one of the positive elements of this story, is that your audience has something to give. They may not realize it, but they do. In any case, I spent 2 years in this difficult transition, 3 years getting set up at Argus. Again, I'm lucky to call John Eade a friend. We're still in touch. My wife and I were in Lower Manhattan on 9/11. And after that, we decided to leave New York. And there was a small recession after 9/11, short recession. But there weren't too many positions available for what skill set I had then developed, which was as a stock analyst in a particular sector. But I was fortunate enough to get a position with Federated, now called Federated Hermes, in Pittsburgh in 2002, and I've been there 21 years and have moved up the ranks. You can think of it as a transition from historian of modern Russia at the University of Wyoming in Laramie, Wyoming, to portfolio manager and writer of finance at Federated Hermes in Pittsburgh. It wasn't that easy. It was much easier.
ring a bell, the story like this, I imagine, either, right?
Yeah, this belongs in the Academic Journal of Irreproducible Results. And no career counselor in the right mind would suggest this as a crazy. I mean, it was crazy. Mm-hmm. It was nuts. And I was making it up as I went along. Uh-huh. But that also, there is a lesson, hopefully we'll get to, about risk-taking. Is a really important consideration as academics face the world and humanities people face the world. There's a different calibration of risk in the academic world,
sure,
academic thinking, and then a separate calibration or reality of risk in the business world. So much easier in the retelling, mm-hmm, than it was in the doing, but mm-hmm, kind of all's well that ends well. And when I say all's well that ends well, I want to make this point. I think that when I was in academia, I shared the prejudice that most of us in academia have, that we live the life of the mind and no one else does.
I think a lot of people think this way. True.
Yeah. And it's wrong. I work with some of the smartest people I've ever met, including in academia, in business. Now, it's mm-hmm not always the case, but if you're fortunate enough, you come across them, they come across you, and you end up working together. I'm mm-hmm very fortunate in that. And I have kind of the ability to engage people in questions of the life of the mind as much as I did in academia, I would argue. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of an extreme statement for a lot of people still in academia, but I will stand by it. And the partial evidence in support of that conclusion is that after I got settled in the new business, I was able to start writing the books, which you very kindly referenced. Folks, I do have a new book coming out. I cannot help myself. Please take a look. The Ownership Dividend, the Upcoming Paradigm Shift in the U.S. Stock Market, coming out with Routledge February 14th, 2024, Valentine's Day. What will make your sweetheart's heart beat faster than a book about capital markets theory, history, and future? Again,
nothing I can think of.
So my point is the life of the, another good point of this story is the life of the mind and thinking about issues structurally, writing about them, publishing them, if that's important to you. It was important to me. I still have kind of an academic DNA. Mm-hmm. That happened. It is doable. I think people should not assume that the only publishing world is you know, academic journals, which again, I might in a churlish moment suggest that fewer people read than some of the practitioner books that I write now are more widely read. So it's worked out well.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for this extensive response. I caught a couple of things, if you allow me to backtrack a little bit. I really appreciate that you mentioned, you know, this word doubts, and also some of the hard moments, because I think we tend to imagine very often looking at CVs, very near transitions and kind of progressions, whereas you make it clear, you made it clear, and I don't want to reopen some, you know, little scars here from your days trying to figure out the Excel, but it wasn't easy, right? I mean, do you remember some of those moments where it was going through your head?
Yeah, you have doubts about your ability. You're going up against 23-year-olds who have the skill sets, and so you really, it does psychologically become. Imagine if you were walking in. I aimed for consulting firms in Manhattan, mm-hmm, and I was a historian from the University of Wyoming with a PhD in modern Russian history, trying to work on my particular area of interest at the time was air transport, so airline and air transport consulting, and imagine being on the receiving end of my call or my resume, my CV. And this was pre-internet, folks. I mean, the internet existed, but the pre-web-ish, and it was a lot of phone calls and mail and written documents, cover letters and resumes and so forth. And, you know, slam, no response, nothing, zero, slam shut. I tell a story. The firm that eventually hired me, I got through on the phone to the CEO of the firm, a small consulting firm, uh-huh, and I had not my 30-second elevator pitch. I had my 7 or 8 second elevator pitch, because that was all the time I was going to get. I'd been, you know, hung up on many a time, and he bellowed into the phone. He still bellows with me. I go out to dinner with him a couple times a year now. He bellowed into the phone when I did my 7 second pitch. He said, "Yeah, I know who you are. You got nothing." And he slam the phone down. You got nothing. That's the sound in New York. You got nothing. And I was dumb enough to think that was, it's a little bit like the Jim Carrey film, Do I Have a Chance? I forget the name of the film. You know, is there still a chance? I was dumb enough to think, well, you know, at least I got him on the phone. I must have a chance. And believe it or not, I didn't give up after that. And one of his partners at that firm said he wanted someone with a humanities background because he had a bunch of business people, but they didn't write very well. They didn't speak very well. And he understood that he had a humanities background himself. He understood that that would make a difference. He'd gone on and gotten an MBA and followed a traditional business path, but he was willing to take a chance on me to add kind of in a barbell fashion with his technical staff. It worked out terribly, but it was 12 months of on-the-job training. I was a little bit better when I left that job than when I began. And I had a few more transition jobs, and eventually I crawled and scraped and clawed my way forward until I had bare minimum Excel, bare minimum accounting, bare minimum understanding of cash flow statements and business analysis, and was able to make my way eventually to as I said, what I consider safe territory, Argus, meaning a very good platform to develop those skills. So but it was hard, bridge. And the doubt was there.
It was there. Yeah, particularly then, I imagine, the 90s, the conversation about alternative careers from academia wasn't as vibrant, normally as vibrant as it is today, right? So I can imagine that.
I when I started maybe 10, 15 years ago, circling back to my academic friends and academic organizations, I was already well situated in this career. Even I, over the last 10 or 15 years, the alternative careers panels at the professional associations didn't exist 25 years ago.
Right.
They may have existed 10 or 15 years ago, but everyone was scared to go. Now, the alternative careers panels at the professional associations, you know the one in our case, Patrick, ACES or former AAAAS, it's very well attended. And it's not an embarrassment to show up at the alternative careers panel. And in fact, you see not only PhD students, you see sometimes junior faculty who are in adjunct positions who understand, have come to the realization later rather than sooner, that a lifetime of an adjunct position turns out to be a bad idea. It turns out, and this is a topic I want to raise, and maybe now's a good point, about risk taking, if I may, if that's okay.
Sure.
So it turns out I could be fired by the time we finish recording this. I'm an employee at will.
Right.
And most people in business are employees at will. We're recording this 2:15 on a Friday. The email could be behind this screen that we're recording this on saying, it's Friday, it's the holiday season. That's when businesses tend to terminate people. You're gone. I'm sorry. It didn't work out. And that's just in the nature of business. And that, I think, is terrifying for a lot of people who have academic backgrounds. And I suppose it should be, but it's sort of the norm in the world. And people who go into academia, I concluded, tend to be risk averse. And there's nothing wrong with that. They choose academia or come to the conclusion that academia, because you have these structured jobs, tenure track jobs, stable businesses, the universities themselves, that it's a low risk career. Granted, they all know it's also a low financial career range, but it's a low risk career. And that business is a high risk career, higher rewards, but higher risk. And they're more or less comfortable with risk taking.
Low risk if you get tenure, at least, right?
It becomes very low risk if you get tenure. Really, they have to shut down the whole department to get rid of you. So that's the goal for a lot of people. If they get tenure, they're in good shape. Yeah, they're not going to make a mint, but it's a very secure job. And I think it's psychologically, people who are inclined towards that are the same people who are inclined towards that, to be circular. That is, they go into academia. I want to question that logic. Because if you're 40 years old and an adjunct professor, did you end up in a low-risk career? No, you did not. You ended up in a very high-risk career. And while, yeah, the business world is at risk, I think too many people in academia delude themselves into thinking that it is a low-risk career. If you get tenure at a good university or a very energetic teacher in a teaching position and you know, have the energy necessary to do that, and you become indispensable to the institution, that's also low risk. That works. I get it. But there are more people there than do get more people in the system than get tenure at R1s and are super teachers and really derive great pleasure and job security from teaching. Right. And they've ended up making what they thought was a low risk decision and ended up being a high risk decision.
Right.
So I don't think the business community is quite as bad as it seems from a risk perspective, because I think there's to some degree a false sense of job security and risk in academia that I don't know that's there.
And of course, you think about risk every day as part of your job, right?
So 100%, it's 110% of my job. I thought about at an earlier stage in my career, you think about doing things. You have certain tasks. At this point in my career, I sit back and think about, okay, all of this system is in progress.
Mm-hmm.
What could go wrong?
Mm-hmm.
What could go wrong?
Mm-hmm.
What can go wrong? I have people now doing the things that need to get done, and I have to sit and figure out, think about risk. And it's probably that, reaching that point in my career, which made me think back, you know, there's a flaw in the academic reasoning than to think that it's a low-risk career. In fact, if you look at it from a flow perspective, a mechanical system perspective, all those adjunct profs represent a high-risk
career. Of course, but I think it's also important to notice that the academia has become higher and higher risk as we speak. It's very different even today than it was 20, 30 years ago, right? In that it's structured, the faculty, permanent faculty versus adjunct. So
yeah,
you're absolutely right.
And there are departments that are shutting down in, you know, school, even places where tenure is not as tenured as it might have been in previous decades. So risk is showing up in academia. I think that the best thing psychologically for people in academia is to just acknowledge it. And if they want that risk, that's great. But to pretend it's not there, I don't think is the right psychological approach.
Sure. And I'd like to come back to this question towards the end, actually, because maybe there's something to be said about how departments can address this question. Meanwhile, I just wanted to backtrack very quickly and something that, again, jumped out at me from your earlier comment. That was this issue of self-confidence. You moved yourself into this without realizing maybe that this adventure would be. I wonder if, you know, part of the package of becoming a PhD is actually, you know, this ability to master self-confidence. You know, you've written a book, you've gone through a number of defenses, you've fielded so many questions. And so you've acquired a certain amount of thick skin that maybe makes you think that if you did this, you can do anything. And it's not a bad thing. What's your
take? I agree. And I would refer to it as a different term, a business term. I just call it project management. If you have finished a PhD, guess what? You have a certificate in project management. You saw a project through definition, conception, planning, funding, execution, measurement, wrap up. Delivery to the deliverable to the customer, that is your board, et cetera. There was a follow-on project for many PhDs of trying to get their book or at least several articles published. It turns out that's project management skill. That's very important. So now a lot of academics have egos independent of their project management skills. But in terms of project management, when the guy hung up on me, and his name's David Tritel. We'll call him because call him out. He's in Miami. He's kind of semi-retired. And as I said, a friend of mine from Simmet Hellison and Eichner was the name of the air transport consultancy. They no longer exist. Long ago purchased. I just called up some others and continued. I wasn't dumb enough to realize or smart enough. Excuse me. I wasn't smart enough to realize, you know, that's a hard no. I just kept going because perhaps I had, whether it was the academic self-confidence or the project management self-confidence, if particularly in business, if it doesn't work with one client, you don't give up. You just go to the next prospect and you keep moving. And so, being a wallflower, if you're a wallflower, you're probably not going to finish your PhD very successfully or very quickly. And that's a sign. if you do finish your PhD in reasonable time, in reasonable order, reasonable publications, you have project management skills that you can go out along with the writing skills and the research skills and the communication skills that the world is in desperate need of.
The other thing that struck me when you were talking earlier about moving away from Soviet history, I mean, as a fellow Russianist, I have to say, moving to late 1990s was arguably one of the most exciting times to be in the field, just because of all the archives that were opening and the things that you could do, and possibly maybe the name that one could make for oneself based on these newly declassified archival resources, right? So, but you say, you know, you were anticipating that this momentum would peter out in a short period of time.
Yeah, I could have been wrong, but I think I was right, actually. So I did catch the archive openings. I mean, I was kind of there on day one. It was a little bit earlier. I arrived for my full IREX year in September of 1991, and I had substantially unfettered access to Communist Party archives, regional party archives, central archives. And, you know, I didn't go into the NKVD archives or the military archives. That wasn't my topic, but I got I got really what Central Party Committee archives. I was in 91, 92, 93, 94, so I was very pleased with that. Hopefully the research showed that, and it was an exciting time. And matter of fact, even in the late 90s, as I was making those 2 years that shall not be named or reviewed in great detail, I actually did a couple months in business in Russia. Total, complete disaster. Yeah, we don't know. It never happened. But boy, was it a mess. So it was part of that 2 years of transition between leaving academia and showing up at Argus. And so it was a very interesting period. There were, you know, gunfights in the restaurants in the middle of Moscow. I was there. I was, you know, ducking my head. But
you were living in Robin too, the movies, right?
Yes. But I wasn't, it wasn't a good career situation. It was kind of chaos. And so in September of 1998, I left Russia. That little part of the experiment failed and made my way back to the United States slowly. And so it was a very interesting time. But in terms of academic buildup, it wasn't. And I'm others will know better than me, but in terms of positions, tenured positions in modern Russian history, I do believe, despite the excitement of the 1990s, if I'm not mistaken, and others can correct me, the dynamism and marginal positions were already, after Russia failed as the Cold War state, the Soviet Union failed, the marginal positions were moving to Middle Eastern studies and Chinese studies. And frankly, they probably, with good reason, were moving there. And so the job prospects, despite the fact that Russia had now become a very interesting non-academic engagement, on the academic front, I sensed it was not going to be growing, and that's what led to my decision.
Could you talk about what you did at Argus day to day?
Yeah, and this is where the transition or the life of the mind, but in a maybe in a lesser sense, but the skills that academics do bring to the table, and they undersell and don't realize that the business community, any business community, desperately needs those skills. Let's say your business is publishing a poetry magazine. You would think that it's all about the poetry. No, publishing a poetry magazine is a business. It needs people to get things done on time and communicate about them. So now finance is also a business. It also needs people to get things done on time and communicate about them.
Which is what historians do.
Which is what historians do. So whether you define your alternative career as government service, an NGO, a nonprofit, or the business community, the skills that academics bring to the table are underappreciated. Again, clear writing, memo writing is not taught at Harvard Business School. It just isn't. I mean, maybe it, who knows, but I doubt it. You don't, there's no evidence that it's taught there. University of Chicago, definitely not taught there. So the those skills are really important, and a platform, a research platform, even though the topic was the stock market and individual securities, you just do a lot of writing at Argus. And I was doing a lot of writing at Federated internally for internal my peers and supervisors. So if you're doing if you're looking at a system, stock market's a system, and you're analyzing it, yes, you're doing a lot of spreadsheet work. But at the end of the day, you have to communicate, summarize, and communicate and convince, persuade people that your view of the world is correct, your analysis is correct. You have to stand up in front of people, either write a memo or stand up and give a speech. Well, it turns out a lot of academics are not half bad at that. That is their ability to write memos, to put together a written argument. Again, their dissertation is an extended written argument. The summary of your dissertation is a short written argument. Those are invaluable in business then, now, and in the future. It's an underappreciated skill. And that's something I think that a lot of your listeners should take to heart. That's the good news. That skill set is there, and it's not taught in the business schools.
That's very useful information. Let's talk about you as a historian in finance, right? That's a kind of a value added that you showcase yourself very often. There's an obvious connection to our people, at least, between cultural history of the Soviet Union and being a finance analyst, on top of the skills that you just mentioned, right? Like writing, communication, critical thinking. Like, you found a connection between history in particular and built your career around it, it seems. Yeah, as you made it part of your professional brand. So let's start with your first impressions of the industry. You walk into the industry, your first job, you start looking around, you think about it, and you mention your first impressions in your first coming book, The Ownership Dividend. You write that you were struck by how ahistorical the investment profession is. With a few exceptions, you say, most investors have limited time horizons, both forward and backward. How does it manifest to you, and where did you see an opportunity to change that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for teeing that one up, because that's kind of the fun part. I really enjoy being a historian in the capital markets for the reason that you just identified. I did not have the luxury of being a historian in the capital markets when I had those first few jobs, whether it was Argus, early years at Federated, or those transition jobs that shall not be named. I was way too busy scrambling, memorizing, taking tests, the CFA exam, learning Excel, learning business, just memorize it. No reflection.
Yeah.
But once I was settled in, I had the opportunity as a historian to think, well, you know, I'm as a historian, I always, where'd this come from? I'm really interested in where things come from. Because that's why I went to grad school in history. Where'd things come from? Why is this way? And you apply, now when you're in a professional historian environment, everyone's doing the same thing, and that's the whole purpose of the exercise. When you're in business, nobody's doing that. And it becomes very interesting. And you have a set of rules. For instance, I had to very quickly memorize a set of rules to get credentials in the industry, the CFA exam.
Okay.
As certified chartered financial analyst. They changed the name a couple decades ago. So I quickly memorized the rules. I didn't ask where they came from. I had to memorize them. If I was going to be serious in the career, I had to memorize those rules. But once I was settled, I started asking where those rules come from. I started reading as a historian where those rules came from. And I asked the question, as a historian might, well, why did those rules, those formulas, why were they developed? Who developed them and why? And there is a literature on that. But then again, as a historian, yes, well, those rules, in the case of a book I wrote in 2018 called Getting Back to Business about modern portfolio theory, those rules were written in the 1950s and 60s to fix some very serious problems from the 1920s and 30s. That's why those rules were developed.
And what was the implication of that, of the insight?
Actually, the insight was that in the 2020s or the 2010s, you have to ask yourself as an investor, do those rules still apply?
Right.
Are they still necessary? They were fixing problems from the 1920s and 1930s. Well, those problems in the 1920s and 1930s don't exist anymore. They were fixed in the 1950s and 60s.
Right. So the rules were irrelevant.
The rules were dated. Mm-hmm. Also, if you remember, the 1950s and 60s was the high water mark of social science, of mm-hmm. human beings being machines, part of systems in equilibrium, mm-hmm. rational, maximizing, utility maximizing creatures, fully rational. In New York, you know who Robert Moses is. It was the height of the Robert Moses age. Robert mm-hmm. Moses was an urban developer who knew better than everyone else he was going to create modernity for New Yorkers. It turned out to be mm-hmm. a disaster. Mm-hmm. But he had the confidence, the Apollo confidence, Apollo meaning sending men to the moon. Problems can be who was the head of Ford? McNamara. McNamara's confidence at Ford. There are social science answers to, McNamara became Secretary of Defense, and tragically as it were. The social science answers and mechanical answers, physics answers for mm-hmm. human problems. Mm-hmm. So the rules that are now being applied in the stock market, we're taping this at 2:30 on an afternoon, the stock market's mm-hmm. open. The rules that are being applied are really from the height of 1960s social science overconfidence about mm-hmm. the ability to master the human condition.
So it was a monument to an era in some ways.
It was a monument to an era, and guess what? Those rules are still being applied right mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. And for me as an investor, as a business person, I'm saying, well, mm-hmm. you know what? Yeah, I see they fixed the 1920s and 30s problem. Bravo, congratulations. But I'm not really sold on this 1950s and 60s mastery of the human condition. I'm going to do something different than mm-hmm. I feel actually is more historically normal rather than historically anomalous. Mm-hmm. And that literally led to the investment style that I happen to work in, a very specific, mm-hmm. right now it's kind of a boutique style, but at one time it was the norm. It got pushed aside by all of a number of phenomena. That's the topic of the book coming out, mm-hmm. Your Valentine's Day gift to your sweetheart, coming out on February 14th. Is to what happened in the last couple of decades and why it's a historically anomalous, and therefore from an investment perspective, also why you may want to consider investing mm-hmm. in a different fashion than what you've been doing the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. And so it's really placing these frameworks in historical context. I would argue mm-hmm. as an extension of that, and just kind of for the sake of conversation at a podcast level, that if you're a brain surgeon, you want to know not only what the current best practices are, mm-hmm. but you also want to know where they came from and how they evolved. Mm-hmm. If you're a plumber, you want to know, now this is a stretch, but just bear with me. If you're a plumber, mm-hmm. you also want to know the history of plumbing. Things mm-hmm. that have been tried, things that have worked, things that have failed, things that didn't work. Mm-hmm. As you encounter new problems in plumbing, in supply, materials, water, in design of systems, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Knowing the history of any system that you happen to be part of
can be helpful.
Doesn't matter what mm-hmm. the system is. And in finance, not much of that going around. And that has become sort of a base of a business for me is appealing to those customers who are more comfortable with this, I'll call it historically validated approach, rather than what is currently the norm, which I don't think is going to last much longer. It's had 30 years. I don't think it's going to last much longer. So it does have practical implications as mm-hmm. to how you run a business.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk more about your book. And maybe we could push this question a little further, if you don't mind unveiling a little bit of your argument. You're right, and I had the pleasure of reading the preview of your book, that historically this relationship between companies and their owners was based on dividends, cash payments, based on profits. But the cash relationship has been waning in the U.S. For 3 decades now, it seems. And so the question is, why did the practice of dividends diminish in popularity? And why do you think that it will or should come back?
Yeah, so I don't know how many of your regular audience will be super interested in this, but we'll do this detour and see how it goes. We had a moment in time, really from 1980 to 2020, and some of this is social science. There's a chapter on geopolitics, which would interest some of your audience. But there was this coincidence in time that created, I'm not call it a perfect storm, but a paradigm that's been very successful, by the way, in from a financial perspective, not so certain if it will be judged as kindly in future decades, but you had a bunch of things occurring all at once. First was the decline in interest rates. The older listeners and younger listeners who will look it up will know, and they may not even know what interest rate is, but take my word for it, it was very, very high in the late 70s and early 80s. Peaked in 1981 for the type of interest rate that matters to my business. And then it came down for 40 years and bottomed in September of 2020. So 40 years of declining interest rates, that has profound implications on risk, decision-making. We're talking about decision-making risk. Mm-hmm. Well, in the business world, that interest rate is a proxy for risk. And if you have interest rates going down for 40 years, that means people are taking more and more risk. And I would argue making worse decisions, but others could debate that, but no one can disagree about risk coming down over that time period. Mm-hmm. The second framework of that, something kind of inside baseball called share buybacks, which have, we won't get into it. I'll just say they became legal or more legal. They were legal before, but they became more legal in 1982, an SEC rule. And buybacks have basically displaced dividends. Mm-hmm. The third thing is NASDAQ and all that wonderful innovation coming from Silicon Valley. A lot of startup companies, they're not supposed to pay dividends, nor should they. That's fine. But NASDAQ grew and kind of took over the whole stock market. And we read about them and hear about them, the Magnificent Seven or the Fangs, all these, all the big tech companies that you're aware of. They emerged on the scene in this period. The part mm-hmm. that's geopolitically relevant and is the maybe more directly relevant to a social scientist or humanities person is what happens in 1979. Deng Xiaoping comes to power in China. Margaret Thatcher is elected in Great Britain. 1980, Ronald Reagan is elected in the United States. And you usher in the period of what is now called global neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. And global neoliberalism is characterized by globalization, deregulation, the unfettered march of capital. As a practical matter, it means your little widget mm-hmm. is made in China and sold to you in Walmart in an incredibly deflationary or low cost manner. Mm-hmm. And that happened for 40 years. The consequences, you get lots of widgets from China and you can fill your house with them. The negative consequence was the industrial heartland got wiped out. The middle class really took it on the chin in this country, the working middle class and the industrial middle class. But in terms of consumption, in terms of the stock market, in terms of innovation and technology, very, very successful period. It looked like Francis Fukuyama, who your listeners will know, was right. And all's well that ends well, and this ended well, et cetera, et cetera. All of that self-confidence and reality came to a crashing, explosive end over the last several years. You could argue it started with 2016 with Donald Trump, but let's just say 2020 mm-hmm. With COVID in China ending the supply chain, 2022 with Russia invading Ukraine and ruining Fukuyama's party, mm-hmm. And 2021 or 2016 or today with Donald Trump and the division of the United States and the end of a consensus that we even need a consensus in this country that whatever we were doing in the past is worth agreeing on, et cetera. There's no agreement. We see that every day in the news in this country right now. So there is no consensus among kind of the investing community or the policy community as to what goes forward and whether the Republic is even a good idea. We'll find out next year. This 40-year period of the march of capital of global neoliberalism had a stock market consequence, back to my day job, of pushing dividends to the side. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, it worked really well that you just do harvested capital gains. As share prices just went up and up and up and up, and you didn't really need a dividend anymore because if you needed to pay the rent or fund something, what we call fund consumption, you just sold shares. The argument in the book is that interest rates have stopped going down. The global supply chains make everything in China. That's come to an end. Mm-hmm. Russia invaded Ukraine and shocked European sensibilities. Right. Donald Trump has destroyed any consensus in this country or is a reflection of the end of any consensus in this country. And mm-hmm. so that I think that the risk premium or the risk attachment, the discounted cash flows, however you want to do it in an academic finance sense, but the amount of risk that you apply to an investment is going up. It had been going down for decades. And the cash nexus, which had been erased from stock investments in the United States, I think it's going to come back. And that's basically the argument. Now, I am talking my book of business, so full disclosure, my day job is dividend-based, and this basically argues that dividends are going to be a more prominent part of the stock market. But that's the argument based on a historical analysis of how anomalous the last 30 or 40 years have been.
Right, and it's interesting for me, even though most people aren't finance experts among the audience, but it's an interesting case study of how historical thinking can be applied to essentially practical ends, right? I mean, you make those, you use the language of history, you talk about structures, you talk about narratives, you give analogies, you talk about, how cash essentially has been the essence of the relationship between companies and owners for most of the history. So historically, it's been a norm rather than an exception, right?
Yeah, and the best way to think about that is just anything outside the stock market: farmland, real estate, your job. How many people? Most people are paid in cash. Most owners of businesses take some sort of profit distribution in order to pay their own bills. Think about owning farmland. That the only way, let's say you buy farmland for 10 years, you're not allowed to take a single profit from the sale of the crops to pay your own bills. The only way you can benefit from it is if you sell the land. That's basically what a dividend-free stock is. Now, if the farmland is fallow or is troubled or is flooded, of course there's no dividend. And you invest in the farmland to make it productive again. But any business, a McDonald's franchise, the bookstore down the street, rental real estate, they are all based on the health of that enterprise is all based on the cash flows from the enterprise, not its price in the market. And the anomalous outcome that we've seen in the last couple of decades for these large tech companies, really, but many other companies as well, is that instead of measuring success in distributable cash flows the way other stock markets, other businesses, real estate, individuals in their professions do, is instead, no, you sell your stake in order to pay the rent on a monthly basis. It's kind of crazy. So that's been my assertion. It's kind of controversial because, frankly, this historically based assertion, everyone in the stock market's pretty comfortable with how things have worked out the last couple of decades. I'm suggesting that's going to come to an end.
I was going to ask actually, what's been the feedback that you've received so far based on the sort of tease of your argument that the book is not out yet, but I'm sure you've run the ideas by your friends and colleagues in the industry.
Well, here's a finance answer to that, or an academic answer: selection bias. So I've been in this business, including writing, for a long enough time that my group of friends all agree with me, and the people who are busy speculating in stocks aren't going to stop to read a book by a dividend guy. They couldn't care less. So among the more conservative investors that I have found myself aligned with, they say, yeah, that all makes sense. Yeah, maybe this, maybe that, but sure, as a general notion. But the speculators we don't cross circles. So part of the intent of publicizing a book, of writing it, is to get that out. Well, I refer to my audience as practitioners. They tend to be the financial advisors. The financial advisors really do have a vested interest in understanding where things are going to go, because they look bad if they get it wrong. And so they need to be a little bit more open-minded. Now, most investors choose their type of investment and kind of stick with it. That's their style. But financial advisors who are working on behalf of retirees or people who don't want to think about the stock market, they have to be open-minded to paradigm shifts. So they're really my target audience to explain to them. And we'll see how the reception has gone. It tends to be a selection bias exercise, meaning those financial advisors that are more conservative, they nod their head and said, yeah, I get it. Those that want to know where the next IPO is coming from or the next stock that's going to be a so-called 10-bagger, they don't have the time of day for me.
Right. Yeah. No, based on what you're saying, it really sounds like you know, putting in evidence what you, your assertion that you made earlier, the intellectual life in finance being out of room because you have to think about so many things. You only think about the hardware and how it functions and the structure of it and where it's going and where it's been. So it's really in many ways like being a historian, except there are some practical stakes attached to it, right?
Yeah, and the other, you know, senior people in the firm, they do the same thing I do. They sit around and think about risk. And they think about paradigm change, and they think about, they have to make investment decisions. Some think about risk as, you know, what could go wrong. That's, you know, others are also thinking about structurally, where is this business heading? Whatever it is, the poetry publishing business, the brain surgery business, the plumbing business, or the investment business.
Right.
They have to think about, where's this heading? And, you know, how do we position ourselves to be there to continue to exist? As it were, and prosper. And so, you know, that's how a lot of senior executive time is thought. It is the life of the mind. It is structural thought. It's not just, you know, what do we do today? It's it's what do we do over the next decade?
Right. Okay, so, let's come back to this question of risk that you mentioned at the very beginning, because I remember, and you mentioned that when we talked last time, when I reached out to you first, you are of the opinion that academics, you know, you've had certain experiences hiring academics, PhDs, and you hang up the opinion that they are a self-selected group who are averse to risk by nature. I wonder if there's a way that, you know, there is this group that you might amount, but there's also a group that simply doesn't realize how to capitalize on, you know, on a certain level of immunity of being able to take the risk in a certain way. They don't want to hold on to the structure outside academia, and they stay in academia simply because they don't know that they have the tools that they can use somewhere else. So the question is, do you think it might be a possibility, and what can departments and the individuals themselves do in order to sort of broaden their horizons when they consider their future careers?
Yeah, and I think that, let me see if I can kind of summarize my recommendations. Some have already been stated. We'll start with the risk one, and that's more psychological. But I think knowing is better than not knowing. And so if you are in academia, or going into academia, or considering leaving academia, just be aware of this risk profile and know where you stand. You know yourself better than anyone else. Are you comfortable with risk? Are you not comfortable with risk? I can't fix that. But you will handle it better, at least knowing where you are on that spectrum. Right. And I think I had never even considered the nature of risk. And so I think just calling it out helps. And it's more of a personal dialogue, an inner dialogue with you. But to realize also, take the big picture that being in academia can also be risky. And just making peace with the fact that being in business or outside of academia, there is risk. It's not the end of the world. Most people find a way. And it can be, you know, there can be some antacids, some Pepto-Bismol along the way. It can be frightening. It was frightening. It was a dispiriting. But that it can be worked out. Everyone kind of figures it out at the end where their right risk tolerance is.
Right.
But if you artificially limit yourself to that you want so-called no risk, you're going to end up in a very risky situation. So I think the solution there is not a solution. It's just awareness. There are
trying things out, letting yourself try things out where you don't have as much to lose as maybe you would later.
As you perceive, and right? Talk it out, and, you know, realize it, just realizing it. So that's point one. The risk is there. Just acknowledge it. I think you'd be better positioned to deal with risk when it materializes. The other stuff is pretty straightforward. I hate to be so incredibly simple about it, but Excel or sheets is worth learning. I would tell you, and again, this is more on the business side, but accounting is a language. Now, all of us in the social studies, social sciences, humanities, we have to learn languages of various sorts. I had to learn Russian, and, you know, had to have a reading ability of some basic reading ability of German and French, but had to be pretty good in Russian. Accounting is a language.
Right.
It's not a very hard language. It's tourist Spanish. It really is. Accounting can be done on Duolingo, not on Duolingo. You get my point, but it can be term, you know, Chan Academy or whatever.
Take a LinkedIn course or something.
LinkedIn, like whatever. Yeah. And an online course, YouTube, an Accounting for Dummies book. It is, you can learn to order coffee and a meal in a restaurant. That helps because it helps you pretty quickly understand enterprises, even if they're nonprofits or government enterprises, or doing something on your own or a business. It helps you just understand how things are flowing in that business. It just provides better understanding of the structure of the system. It's an academic approach. You do not need an accounting degree. You do not need to be a CPA. But just some basic understanding of accounting, and it can be done in a non-certified way, meaning if you're an undergraduate or a graduate student, you can do a LinkedIn course. You can, you know, a couple nights a week, et cetera. And that helps enormously. The other kind of self-evident, or not to me self-evident, but not from the outside, from an academic perspective, is a course or just a book on, I hate to say this, pop psychology. You'd be stunned the amount of business decisions that were made out of a psychology 101. We are humans. I mean, there are lots of people trying to set up computer-based networks where you get the human out, investment businesses and others. To some extent, blockchain is a way of getting rid of trust systems. You get rid of people by making it just computer to computer and so forth. That's fine. But the people who set up the blockchain were the people who set up the algorithms for quantitative investment. They have personalities. And I have found it helpful to just have a superficial familiarity with normal and abnormal psychology. You're going to run into both. And frankly, if you're in academia, you're going to run into a lot more abnormal psychology. So even if you're staying, it can't hurt to understand the system. Now, again, the academics description of psychology is probably woefully out of date and inaccurate, but it's at least a starting point to understand
things. Management is psychology. You deal with people, right? Selling is psychology. You're selling to people. You want them to buy the product, right? So it only makes sense to sort of read a textbook and figure out the basically actions of
People. And when you're running a meeting, when you're in a meeting with your peers, superiors, or the people who report to you, you need to know the meeting, all meetings, you should know what the outcome of the meeting is before you go in. That's preparation. But in order to achieve that goal, you have to understand the psychology of the participants. You don't have to have a degree in it. Again, you just have to have some bit. You have to think about it. It's not cut and dried. Here's what we're going to do. It's what does that my counterparty think that we're going? How does he perceive or he or she perceive what we're going to do? And how can I present it so that he or she perceives it to be in their interest as well?
That's great advice.
So basic psych, basic accounting, Excel. I hate to say, I mean, to reduce a business career 25 years, what you usually, take an Excel course, an accounting course, and a psych course, and you'll be fine. You have to have an interest. You have to have, you know, interest in various things. But even if you don't have an interest, those three are some very simple things that you can do. The other ones that I'm taking for granted, but if you don't have them, are the writing and presentation and speaking skills. They're really in short supply. Not everyone in academia is comfortable with public speaking. They ought to be.
But we're more likely to have those than, you know, Excel and Psychology 101 behind our
I'm going to assume, because in my experience, I have seen that almost everyone coming out of an academic environment has those skills, but should not underweight them or discount them. They are really, really important. The other thing is, this is more internet related. You know, if you are going to consider a career transition or movement out, start writing about it, start researching it on your own. Don't wait. They're not going to come to you. Not going to find you. And the internet allows you to do that. You make yourself, a friend of mine quoting someone else on the internet says, if you do something on the internet for 5 years, by the end of the 5 year period, you're going to be one of the few people still doing it, meaning you basically take intellectual market share. I don't know if that's exactly true, but the concept I think is a good one.
So leverage the internet in a way that one couldn't have done 50 years ago, basically, because you had to go through all those.
You reach out to people. LinkedIn is, you compare Twitter to LinkedIn. LinkedIn is a really positive for now resource. Twitter's a really not so much, but it's professional, it's content based, it can be very trivial, people announcing their job anniversaries, but LinkedIn is still a platform for meaningful connection. I take LinkedIn seriously. I view I have a Twitter account. I use it, and I'm trying mm-hmm. to promote my book. And hopefully, I won't be canceled and find my account turned off when this publicizes. That's fine. But Twitter, even the new owner of Twitter understands it's changed over the last couple of years. But it was always a very different environment of communication than LinkedIn has mm-hmm. become. And there are other platforms that are emerging as well. But people have websites, blogs, Substack. If you have a passion about something, start mm-hmm. researching, writing it, and communicating about it, and then you use that as the thin edge of the wedge to move into whatever your passion is. Again, mm-hmm. it could be, I really want to publish poetry journals, and mm-hmm. I'm really good at it. Mm-hmm. You just go ahead and do that. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be, transitioning from, medieval literature to Goldman Sachs. Mm-hmm. The skills that I'm talking about are relevant even for mm-hmm. non-finance careers. But we now have the internet. The internet's not entirely a bad thing. Let's put it that way. It is a platform for people to develop and change their careers.
And of course, you have a very interesting blog that I was able to read several entries from it, where you apply different kind of historical concepts and frameworks to finance. So that's for, I'll definitely mention it to people who promote this podcast too.
Yes, thank you. So you can, I'm happy to, particularly with academics and former academics on LinkedIn, on my website, which is more business related, but I put stuff on Russian history there on strategicdividendinvestor.com. It's just because it was the website that I took 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And if I had to do that all over again, I probably would have chosen something less narrow, but it is what it is. So there are posts on Russian history, Russian demographics, for instance, on strategicdividendinvestor.com. It is what it is. And I'm on a lot of the traditional social media with the handle History Investor.
So one last question, if I may. What is it that, is there anything that in particular that you'd like to do in the future that you haven't done already that maybe connects history and finance in some way?
Right now, I just finished the book. I'm exhausted. I'm promoting the book, which is even more exhausting. The book is a historical account of the U.S. stock market. In 2018, I wrote a historical critique of modern portfolio theory. So two intersections of history and finance. Right now, I don't have the next project in mind. I'm going to say I may even take a slight break. I am interested, this would be more on the side, not on a professional basis, but revisiting the Russia and the West question. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Russia and the West question appeared to have been settled by the academics 20, 30 years ago. And people took the victory laps. Martin Malley had already passed away, but, kind of proven right. And Fukuyama kind of proven right. And everyone's just trying to figure out how that works out, the details, and it was all going to be fine. Mm. And guess what? It didn't work out that way. Right. So, and now there are a lot more people who are not academics who have a vested interest in understanding Russia and the West, because there's basically a war going on, a proxy war between the West and Russia right now. And I think there's room to explain to non-academics in non-academic journals, not mentioning Martin Malia or the academics, that why does Russia appear to behave in a peculiar fashion if you're not paying attention? It appears to be peculiar. Right. If you're a specialist, okay, I get it. Didn't work out exactly the way, but we understand what's going on. But for the non-specialists who are footing the bill, paying the taxes, and are voting about these things, I think a better explainer than is currently available in a non-academic setting about the relationship that Russia and the West has had with itself, the relationship the West has had with Russia and Russia with the West, et cetera, is that there's room for that. If I had time for that, that would be the project I would want to pursue now, just because it's in the news.
So there are horizons to be exploring for all the worst reasons, but it's worth to do.
I do have a day job, and for everyone listening, I plan to stick with my day job. But to the extent I have any extra time, that would be what I'd be working on.
Glenn, thank you very much for this conversation. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Patrick, thank you for having me on the show.